I said, well, what about the comparison companies? And I listed the comparison leaders, and I said, the comparison companies also had leadership. So we had leadership in the good to great companies. We had leadership in the comparison companies. You can't tell me that leadership distinguishes. And this is when the team had its insight. The team pushed back. Their observation was not that the answer is leadership or not, but it is really about a special brand of leadership. And the key insight was that the comparison companies had level 4 leaders, and the good to great companies at their pivotal moments in history had level 5 leaders. By forcing me to confront that it is not a simple leadership or not, but rather this hierarchy of capabilities, the team led us to a breakthrough insight. And the team, first and foremost, should get the credit for that insight. The good to great executives were all cut from that same level 5 cloth. It didn't matter whether the company was consumer or industrial, in crisis or steady state, offered services or products. It didn't matter when the transition took place or how big the company. All the good to great companies had level 5 leadership at the time of transition. Furthermore, the absence of level 5 leadership showed up as a consistent pattern in the comparison companies. Given that level 5 leadership cuts against the grain of conventional wisdom, especially the belief that we need larger-than-life saviors with huge personalities to come riding in and transform our companies, it is vital to note that level 5 is an empirical finding, not ideological. Level 5 leaders are a study in duality, modest and willful, humble and fearless. To quickly grasp this concept, think of United States President Abraham Lincoln, one of the few level 5 presidents in U.S. history, who never let his ego get in the way of his primary ambition for the larger cause of an enduring great nation. Ambition first and foremost that the nation must endure no matter what the cost. Yet those who mistook Lincoln's personal modesty, shy nature, awkward, gangling manner as signs of weakness found themselves terribly mistaken, to the scale of 250,000 Confederate and 360,000 Union lives, including Lincoln's own. While it might be a bit of a stretch to compare the good to great CEOs to Abraham Lincoln, they did display the same duality. Consider the case of Coleman Mockler, CEO of Gillette, from 1975 to 1991. During Mockler's tenure, Gillette faced 3 attacks that threatened to destroy the company's opportunity for greatness. 2 attacks came as hostile takeover bids from Revlon, led by Ronald Perelman, a cigar-chomping raider with a reputation for breaking apart companies to pay down junk bonds and finance more hostile raids. The 3rd attack came from Coniston Partners, an investment group that bought 5.9% of Gillette stock and initiated a proxy battle to seize control of the board, hoping to sell the company to the highest bidder and pocket for themselves a quick gain on their shares. Had Gillette been flipped to Perelman at the price he offered, shareholders would have reaped an instantaneous 44% gain on their stock. Looking at a $2.3 billion short-term stock profit across 116 million shares, most executives would have capitulated, pocketing millions from flipping their own stock and cashing in on generous golden parachutes. Coleman Mockler did not capitulate, choosing instead to fight for the future greatness of Gillette, even though he himself would have pocketed a substantial sum on his own shares. A quiet, reserved man, always courteous, Mockler had the reputation of a gracious, almost patrician gentleman. Yet those who mistook Mockler's reserved nature for weakness found themselves beaten in the end. In the proxy fight, senior Gillette executives reached out to thousands of individual investors, person by person, phone call by phone call, and won the battle. Now you might be thinking, That just sounds like self-serving, entrenched management fighting for their own interests at the expense of shareholder interests. And on the surface, it might look that way. But consider two key facts. Fact number one, Mockler and his team had staked the company's future on huge investments in radically new and technologically advanced systems, later known as Sensor and Mach 3. Had the takeover been successful, these projects would almost certainly have been curtailed or terminated. And none of us would be shaving today with Sensor, Sensor for Women, or the Mach 3, leaving hundreds of millions of people to a more painful daily battle with stubble. Fact number two. At the time of the takeover battle, Sensor promised significant future profits that were not reflected in the stock price because it was in secret development. With Sensor in mind, the board and Mockler believed that the future value of the shares far exceeded the current price, even with the price premium offered by the raiders. To sell out, to take the 44% price premium at that moment, would have made short-term share flippers happy, but would have been utterly irresponsible to long-term shareholders. In the end, Mockler and the board were proved right, stunningly so. If a share flipper had accepted the 44% price premium offered by Ronald Perelman on October 31, 1986, and then invested the full amount in the general market for 10 years through the end of 1996, he would have come out three times worse off than a shareholder who stayed with Mockler and Gillette. Indeed, the company, its customers, and the shareholders would have been ill-served had Mockler capitulated to the raiders, pocketed his millions, and retired to a life of leisure. On a sad note, Mockler was never able to enjoy the full fruits of his effort. On January 25, 1991, the Gillette team received an advanced copy of the cover of Forbes magazine, which featured an artist's rendition of Mockler standing atop a mountain, holding a giant razor above his head in a triumphal pose, while the vanquished languish on the hillsides below. The other executives razzed the publicity-shy Mockler, who had likely declined requests to be photographed for the cover in the first place, amused at seeing him portrayed as a corporate version of Conan the Triumphant. Walking back to his office, minutes after seeing this public acknowledgement of his 16 years of struggle, Mockler crumpled to the floor, struck dead by a massive heart attack. I do not know whether Mockler would have chosen to die in harness, but I'm confident that he would not have changed his approach as chief executive. His placid persona hid an inner intensity, a dedication to making anything he touched the best it could possibly be, not because of what he would get for it, but because he simply couldn't imagine doing it any other way. It wouldn't have been an option within Coleman Mockler's value system to take the easy path and turn the company over to those who would milk it like a cow, destroying its potential to become great, any more than it would have been an option for Lincoln to sue for peace and lose forever the chance of an enduring great nation. Ambition for the company. Setting up successors for success. When David Maxwell became chief executive of Fannie Mae in 1981, the company was losing $1 million every single business day. Over the next 9 years, Maxwell transformed Fannie Mae into a high-performance culture that rivaled the best Wall Street firms, earning $4 million every business day, and beating the general stock market 3.8 to 1. Maxwell retired while still at the top of his game, feeling that the company would be ill-served if he stayed on too long, and turned the company over to an equally capable successor, Jim Johnson. Shortly thereafter, Maxwell's retirement package, which had grown to be worth about $20 million based on Fannie Mae's spectacular performance, became a point of controversy in Congress. Fannie Mae is different than most companies in that it operates under a government charter. Maxwell responded by writing a letter to his successor, in which he expressed concern that the controversy would trigger an adverse reaction in Washington that could jeopardize the future of the company. He then instructed Johnson not to pay him the remaining balance, about $5.5 million, and asked that the entire amount be contributed to the Fannie Mae Foundation for Low-Income Housing. David Maxwell, like Darwin Smith and like Coleman Mockler, exemplified a key trait of Level 5 leaders: ambition first and foremost for the company and concern for its success rather than for one's own riches and personal renown. Level 5 leaders want to see the company even more successful in the next generation. They're comfortable with the idea that most people won't even know that the roots of that success trace back to their efforts. As one Level 5 leader said, "I want to look out from my porch at one of the great companies in the world someday and be able to say, I used to work there." In contrast, the comparison leaders, concerned more with their own reputation for personal greatness, often failed to set the company up for success in the next generation. After all, what better testament to your own personal greatness than that the place falls apart after you leave? In over 3/4 of the comparison companies — now remember, the comparison companies are the mediocre companies that never made a sustained leap from good to great — in over 3/4 of these comparison companies, we found executives who set their successors up for failure, or who chose weak successors, or both. Some of these comparison leaders had the biggest dog syndrome. They didn't mind other dogs in the kennel, as long as they remained the biggest one. One comparison CEO was said to have treated successor candidates, quote, "the way Henry VIII treated wives." Consider the case of Rubbermaid, an unsustained comparison company that grew from obscurity to number one on Fortune's annual list of America's most admired companies, and then, just as quickly, disintegrated into such sorry shape that it had to be acquired by Newell to save itself. The architect of this remarkable story, a charismatic and brilliant leader named Stanley Galt, became synonymous in the late 1980s with the success of the company. In 312 articles collected on Rubbermaid, Galt comes through as a hard-driving, egocentric executive. In one article, he responds to the accusation of being a tyrant with the statement, "Yes, but I'm a sincere tyrant." In another, drawn directly from his own comments on leading change, the word "I" appears 44 times. "I could lead the charge. I wrote the 12 objectives. I presented and explained the objectives." Whereas the word "we" appears just 16 times. Galt had every reason to be proud of his executive success. Rubbermaid had generated 40 consecutive quarters of earnings growth under his leadership, an impressive performance, and one that deserves our respect. But, and this is the key point, Galt did not leave behind a company that would be great without him. His chosen successor lasted only 1 year on the job, and the next in line faced a management team so shallow that he had to temporarily shoulder 4 jobs while scrambling to identify a number 2 executive. Galt's successors found themselves struggling not only with a management void, but also with strategic voids that would eventually bring the company to its knees. Of course, you might say, yes, Rubbermaid fell apart after Galt, but that just proves his personal greatness as a leader. Exactly. Galt was indeed a tremendous Level 4 leader, perhaps one of the best in the last 50 years. But he was not a Level 5 leader, and that is one key reason why Rubbermaid went from good to great for a brief shining moment, and then just as quickly went from great to irrelevant. In contrast to the very I-centric style of the comparison leaders, we were struck by how the good-to-great leaders didn't talk about themselves. During interviews with the good-to-great leaders, they'd talk about the company and the contributions of other executives as long as we'd like, but would deflect discussion about their own contributions. When pressed to talk about themselves, they'd say things like, "I hope I'm not sounding like a big shot," or, "If the board hadn't picked such great successors, you probably wouldn't be talking with me today." Or, "Did I have a lot to do with it? Oh, that just sounds so self-serving. I don't think I can take much credit. We were blessed with marvelous people. Or, there are plenty of people in this company who could do my job better than I do. It wasn't just false modesty. Those who worked with or wrote about the good to great leaders continually used words like quiet, humble, modest, reserved, shy, gracious, mild-mannered, self-effacing, understated, did not believe his own clippings, and so forth. A Nucor board member described Ken Iverson, the CEO who oversaw Nucor's transformation from near bankruptcy into one of the most successful steel companies in the world. Ken is a very modest and humble man. I've never known a person as successful in doing what he's done that's as modest. And I work for a lot of CEOs of large companies. And that's true in his private life as well. The simplicity of him. I mean little things, like he gets his dogs at the local pound. He has a simple house that he's lived in for ages. He only has a carport, and he complained to me one day about how he had to use his credit card to scrape the frost off his windows, and he broke the credit card. Well, you know, Ken, there's a solution for it. Enclose your carport. And he said, ah, heck, it isn't that big of a deal. He's that humble and simple. The 11 good to great CEOs are some of the most remarkable CEOs of the century. Given that only 11 companies from the Fortune 500 met the exacting standards for entry into this study. Yet, despite their remarkable results, almost no one ever remarked about them. George Kane, Alan Wurzel, David Maxwell, Coleman Mockler, Darwin Smith, Jim Herring, Lyle Everingham, Joe Coleman, Fred Allen, Cork Walgreen, Carl Reichardt. How many of these extraordinary executives have you heard of? When we systematically tabulated all 5,979 articles in the study, we found fewer articles surrounding the transition date for the good to great companies than for the comparisons, by a factor of 2. Furthermore, we rarely found articles that focused on the good to great CEOs. The good-to-great leaders never wanted to become larger-than-life heroes. They never aspired to be put on a pedestal or become unreachable icons. They were seemingly ordinary people quietly producing extraordinary results. Some of the comparison leaders provide a striking contrast. Scott Paper, the comparison company to Kimberly-Clark, hired a CEO named Al Dunlop, a man cut from very different cloth than Darwin Smith. Dunlop loudly beat on his own chest, telling anyone who would listen, and many who would prefer not to, about what he had accomplished. Quoted in Business Week about his 19 months atop Scott Paper, he boasted, quote, "The Scott story will go down in the annals of American business history as one of the most successful, quickest turnarounds ever, making other turnarounds pale by comparison," unquote. According to Business Week, Dunlop personally accrued $100 million for 603 days of work at Scott Paper. Do the math. That's $165,000 per day, largely by slashing the workforce, cutting the R&D budget in half, and putting the company on growth steroids in preparation for sale. After selling off the company and pocketing his quick millions, Dunlap wrote a book about himself, in which he trumpeted his nickname, Rambo in Pinstripes. Quote, "I love the Rambo movies. Here's a guy who has zero chance of success and always wins. Rambo goes into situations against all odds expecting to get his brains blown out, but he doesn't. At the end of the day, he succeeds. He gets rid of the bad guys. He creates peace out of war. That's what I do, too." Unquote. Darwin Smith may have enjoyed the mindless Rambo movies as well, but I suspect he never walked out of a theater and said to his wife, "You know, I really relate to that Rambo character. He reminds me of me." Granted, the Scott Paper story is one of the more dramatic in our study, but it's not an isolated case. In over two-thirds of the comparison cases, we noted the presence of a gargantuan personal ego that contributed to the demise or continued mediocrity of the company. We found this pattern particularly strong in the unsustained comparisons. These are cases where the company would show a leap in performance under a talented yet egocentric leader, only to decline in later years. Lee Iacocca, for example, saved Chrysler from the brink of catastrophe, performing one of the most celebrated, and deservedly so, turnarounds in American business history. Chrysler rose to a height of 2.9 times the market at a point about halfway through Iacocca's tenure. Then, however, he diverted his attention to making himself one of the most celebrated CEOs in American business history. Investors Business Daily and the Wall Street Journal chronicled how Iacocca appeared regularly on talk shows like The Today Show and Larry King Live, personally starring in over 80 commercials, entertained the idea of running for president of the United States, quoted at one point, quote, "Running Chrysler has been a bigger job than running the country. I could handle the national economy in 6 months," unquote, and widely promoted his autobiography. The book, Iacocca, sold 7 million copies and elevated him to rock star status, leading him to be mobbed by thousands of cheering fans upon his arrival in Japan. Iacocca's personal stock soared, but in the second half of his tenure, Chrysler's stock fell 31% behind the general market. Sadly, Iacocca had trouble leaving center stage and letting go of the perks of executive kingship. He postponed his retirement so many times that insiders at Chrysler began to joke that Iacocca stood for, "I am chairman of Chrysler Corporation always." And when he finally did retire, he demanded that the board continue to provide private jet and stock options. Later, he joined forces with noted takeover artist Kirk Kerkorian to launch a hostile takeover bid for Chrysler. Chrysler experienced a brief return to glory in the 5 years after Iacocca's retirement, but the company's underlying weaknesses eventually led to a buyout by German carmaker Daimler-Benz. Certainly, the demise of Chrysler as a standalone company does not rest entirely on Iacocca's shoulders. The next generation of management made the fateful decision to sell the company to the Germans. But the fact remains. Iacocca's brilliant turnaround in the early 1980s did not prove to be sustained, and Chrysler failed to become an enduring great company. It is very important to grasp that Level 5 leadership is not just about humility and modesty. It's equally about ferocious resolve and almost stoic determination to do whatever needs to be done to make the company great. Remember Darwin Smith, if you have a cancer in your arm, you have to have the guts to cut off your own arm. Indeed, we debated for a long time on the research team about how to describe the good to great leaders. Initially, we penciled in terms like selfless executive and servant leader, but members of the team objected to these characterizations. "Those labels just don't ring true," said Anthony Chirikos. "It makes them sound weak or meek, but that's not at all the way I think of Darwin Smith or Coleman Mockler. They would do almost anything to make the company great." Then Eve Lee on the team suggested, "Why don't we just call them Level 5 leaders? If we put a label like selfless or servant on them, people will get entirely the wrong idea. We need to get people to engage with the whole concept, to see both sides of the coin. If you only get the humility side, you miss the whole idea." Level 5 leaders are fanatically driven, infected with an incurable need to produce results. They will sell the mills or fire their brother if that's what it takes to make the company great. When George Kane became chief executive of Abbott Laboratories, it sat in the bottom quartile of the pharmaceutical industry, a drowsy enterprise that had lived for years off its cash cow, erythromycin. George Kane didn't have an inspiring personality to galvanize the company, but he had something much more powerful. Inspired standards. He could not stand mediocrity in any form and was utterly intolerant of anyone who would accept the idea that good is good enough. Kane then set out to destroy one of the key causes of Abbott's mediocrity, nepotism. Systematically rebuilding both the board and the executive team with the best people he could find, Kane made it clear that neither family ties nor length of tenure would have anything to do with whether you held a key position in the company. If you didn't have the capacity to become the best executive in the industry in your span of responsibility, then you would lose your paycheck. Such rigorous rebuilding might be expected from an outsider brought in to turn the company around. But Kane, he was an 18-year veteran, insider, and a family member, the son of a previous Abbott president. I often wondered what holidays were like for George Kane. Sorry I had to fire you. You want another slice of turkey? In the end, though, family members were quite pleased with the performance of their stock. For Kane set in motion a profitable growth machine that, from its transition date in 1974 to 2000, created shareholder returns that beat the market 4.5 to 1, handily outperforming industry superstars Merck and Pfizer. Upjohn, the direct comparison company to Abbott, also had family leadership during the same era as George Kane. This shows the power of match pairs. At that pivotal time in the early 1960s, both companies were virtually identical. Similar products, family leadership, similar history, similar sales, and yet different outcomes in the end. See, unlike George Kane, Upjohn's chief executive never showed the same resolve to break the mediocrity of nepotism. By the time Abbott had filled all key seats with the best people, regardless of family background, Upjohn still had B-level family members holding key positions. Virtually identical companies with identical stock charts up to the point of transition, Upjohn then fell 89% behind Abbott over the next 21 years. And then capitulated in a merger to Pharmacia in 1995. As an interesting aside, Darwin Smith, Coleman Mockler, and George Kane came from inside the company. And notice this, Stanley Galt, Al Dunlop, and Lee Iacocca rode in as saviors from the outside, trumpets blaring. This reflects a more systematic finding from our study. The evidence does not support the idea that you need an outside leader to come in and shake the place up to go from good to great. In fact, going for a high-profile outside change agent is negatively correlated with a sustained transformation from good to great. 10 of 11 good-to-great CEOs came from inside the company, 3 of them by family inheritance. The comparison companies, the companies that failed to make a leap from good to great, or even if they did, they failed to sustain it, the mediocre contrast in the study. They turned to outside saviors with 6 times greater frequency, and yet they failed to produce great results. A superb example of insider-driven change comes from Charles R. Cork, Walgreen III, who transformed Doughty Walgreens into a company that outperformed the stock market by over 15 times from the end of 1975 to January 1, 2000. After years of dialogue and debate with his executive team about Walgreens food service operations, Cork sensed that the team had finally reached a watershed point of clarity and understanding. Walgreens' brightest future lay in convenient drugstores, not food service. Dan Jornt, who succeeded Walgreen as chief executive in 1998, described what happened next. Cork said at one of our planning meetings, "Okay, now I'm going to draw a line in the sand. We are going to be out of the restaurant business completely in 5 years." At the time, we had over 500 restaurants. You could have heard a pin drop. He said, "I want to let everybody know the clock is ticking. 6 months later, we were at our next planning committee meeting, and someone mentioned just in passing that we had 5 years to be out of the restaurant business. Cork was not a real vociferous fellow. He sort of tapped on the table and said, "Listen, you have 4.5 years. I said you had 5 years 6 months ago. Now you've got 4.5 years. Well, that next day, things really clicked into gear to winding down our restaurant business. He never wavered. He never doubted. He never second-guessed. Like Darwin Smith selling the mills, Walgreens' decision required stoic resolve. Not that food service was the largest part of the business, although it did add substantial profits to the bottom line. The real problem was more emotional. Walgreens had, after all, invented the malted milkshake, and food service was a long-standing family tradition, dating back to his grandfather. Some food service outlets even named after the CEO himself, a restaurant chain named Corky's. But no matter. If Walgreens had to fly in the face of long-standing family tradition in order to focus its resources where it could be the best in the world, that being the convenient drugstores, Cork would do it. Quietly. Doggedly. Simply. The quiet, dogged nature of Level 5 leaders showed up not only in big decisions like selling off the food service operations or fighting the corporate raiders at Gillette, but also in a personal style of sheer workmanlike diligence. Alan Wurzel, a second-generation family member who took over his family's small company and turned it into Circuit City, perfectly captured the gestalt of this trait. When asked about differences between himself and his counterpart CEO at Circuit City's comparison company, Wurzel summed up, "The show horse and the plow horse." He was more of a show horse, whereas I was more of a plow horse. The window in the mirror. Alan Wurzel's plow horse comment is fascinating in light of two other facts. First, he holds a doctor of jurisprudence from Yale. Clearly, his plow horse nature had nothing to do with a lack of intelligence. Second, his plow horse approach set the stage for truly best-in-show results. Let me put it this way. If you had to choose between $1 invested in Circuit City or $1 invested in General Electric on the day that legendary Jack Welch took over GE in 1981 and held it to January 1, 2000, you would have been better off with Circuit City, and not just by a little bit, by 6 times. Not a bad performance for a plow horse. You might expect that extraordinary results like these would lead Alan Wurzel to discuss the brilliant decisions he made. But when we asked him to list the top 5 factors in his company's transformation, ranked by importance, Wurzel gave a surprising answer. The number 1 factor was luck. "We were in a great industry," he said, "with the wind at our backs." We pushed back, pointing out that we selected the good to great companies based on performance that surpassed their industry's average. Furthermore, the comparison company, Silo, was in the same industry with the same wind and probably bigger sales. We debated the point for a few minutes, with Wurzel continuing his preference for attributing much of his success to just being in the right place at the right time. Later, when we asked to discuss the factors behind the enduring nature of the transformation, he said, "Well, the first thing that comes to mind is luck. I was lucky to find the right successor." Luck. What an odd factor to talk about. Yet the good to great executives talked a lot about luck. In one interview with a Nucor executive, we asked why the company had such a remarkable track record of good decisions. He responded, "I guess we were just lucky." Joseph F. Coleman III, the Level 5 transition CEO of Philip Morris, flat out refused to take credit for his company's success, attributing his good fortune to having great colleagues, successors, and predecessors. Even the book he wrote, a book he undertook at the urging of his colleagues, which he never intended to distribute widely, had the unusual title, "I'm a Lucky Guy." The opening paragraph reads, "I was a very lucky guy from the beginning of my life. Marvelous parents, good genes, lucky in love, lucky in business, and lucky when a Yale classmate had my orders changed to report to Washington, D.C. in early 1941, instead of to a ship that was sunk with all hands lost in the North Atlantic. Lucky to be in the Navy, and lucky to be alive at 85. We were at first puzzled by this emphasis on good luck. After all, we found no evidence that the good to great companies were blessed with more good luck, or bad luck, for that matter, than the comparison companies. Then we began to notice a contrasting pattern in the mediocre comparison executives. They credited substantial blame to bad luck, frequently bemoaning the difficulties of the environment they faced. Compare Bethlehem Steel to Nucor. Both companies operated in the steel industry and produced hard-to-differentiate products. Both companies faced the competitive challenge of cheap imported steel. Yet executives at the two companies had completely different views of the same environment. Bethlehem's chief executive summed up the company's problems in 1983 by blaming imports. Quote, "Our first, second, and third problems are imports," unquote. Ken Iverson and his crew at Nucor considered the same challenge from imports as a blessing, a stroke of good fortune. Almost as if they're saying, aren't we lucky? Steel is heavy, and they have to ship it all the way across the ocean, giving us a huge advantage. Iverson saw the first, second, and third problems facing the American steel industry not to be imports, but American steel management. Iverson even went so far as to speak out publicly against government protection against imports, telling a stunned gathering of fellow steel executives in 1977 that the real problems facing the American steel industry lay in the fact that management had failed to keep pace with innovation. The emphasis on luck turns out to be part of a pattern that we came to call the window and the mirror. Level 5 leaders look out the window to apportion credit to factors outside themselves when things go well. And if they cannot find a specific person or event to give credit to, they credit good luck. At the same time, they look in the mirror to apportion responsibility, never blaming bad luck when things go poorly. The comparison leaders often did just the opposite. They'd look out the window for something or someone outside themselves to blame for poor results, but would preen in front of the mirror and credit themselves when things went well. Strangely, the window and the mirror do not reflect objective reality. Everyone outside the window points inside directly at the level 5 leader, saying, he was the key. Without his guidance and leadership, we would not have become a great company. And the level 5 leader points right back out the window and says, look at all the great people and good fortune that made this possible. I'm a lucky guy. They're both right, of course, but the level 5s would never admit that fact. So let me just do a quick summary of the two sides of level 5 leadership. Again, a level 5 leader is one who is ambitious first and foremost for the cause, the company, the work, not himself or herself. And on the other hand, has the stoic resolve, the will, to do whatever it takes to make good on that ambition. So you've got professional will and personal humility, two sides of a coin. Now, let me just go through those two sides and talk about them very briefly. On the one hand, professional will. A level 5 leader creates superb results, a clear catalyst in the transition from good to great. And yet, on the other hand, personal humility. The level 5 leader demonstrates a compelling modesty, shunning public adulation. A level 5 leader is never boastful. On the one hand, professional will. A level 5 leader demonstrates an unwavering resolve to do whatever must be done to produce the best long-term results, no matter how difficult, no matter how painful. And yet, on the other hand, professional humility. A level 5 leader acts with quiet, calm determination. A level 5 leader relies principally on inspired standards, not inspiring charisma, to motivate. On the one hand, professional will. A level 5 leader sets the standards for building an enduring great company, will settle for nothing less than greatness. And yet, on the other hand, personal humility. A level 5 leader channels ambition into the company, not the self. A level 5 leader sets up successors for even greater success in the next generation. On the one hand, professional will. A level 5 leader looks in the mirror, not out the window, to apportion responsibility for poor results, never blaming other people, external factors, or bad luck. When things go awry, a level 5 leader looks in the mirror and says, "I am responsible." And yet, on the other hand, personal humility. A level 5 leader looks out the window, not in the mirror, to apportion credit for the success of the company, pointing to other people, to other factors, and to good luck. Cultivating Level 5 Leadership. While I was writing this book, I shared the Level 5 finding with a gathering of senior executives. A woman who had recently become chief executive of her company raised her hand and said, "I believe what you say about the good to great leaders, but I'm disturbed because when I look in the mirror, I know I'm not Level 5. Not yet anyway. I don't see a Level 5 staring back. Are you telling me that I can't make this a great company if I'm not Level 5? I don't know for certain that you absolutely must be a Level 5 leader to make your company great," I replied. "I will simply point back to the data. Of 1,435 companies that appeared on the Fortune 500 in our initial candidate list, only 11 companies made the very tough cut into our study. In those 11, all of them had Level 5 leadership in key positions, including the chief executive at the pivotal time of transition." She sat there, quiet for a moment, and you could tell everyone in the room was mentally urging her to ask the question. Finally, she said, "Can you learn to become Level 5? At the time that I wrote this book, my hypothesis was that there are two categories of people: those who do not have the seat of Level 5 and those who do. The first category consists of people who could never in a million years bring themselves to subjugate their egoistic needs to the greater ambition of building something larger and more lasting than themselves. For these people, work will always be first and foremost about what they get: fame, fortune, adulation, power, whatever, not what they build, create, and contribute. The great irony is the animus and personal ambition that often drive people to positions of power stand at odds with the humility required for Level 5 leadership. When you combine that irony with the fact that boards of directors frequently operate under the false belief that they need to hire larger-than-life, egocentric, charismatic leaders to make an organization great, you can quickly see why Level 5 leaders rarely appear at the top of our institutions. The second category of people, and I suspect the larger group, consists of those who have the potential to evolve to Level 5. The capability resides within them, perhaps buried or ignored, but there nonetheless. And under the right circumstances, self-reflection, conscious personal development, a mentor, a great teacher, loving parents, a significant transformational life experience, a Level 5 boss, or any number of other factors, they begin to develop. And looking at the data, we noticed that some of the leaders in our study had significant life experiences that might have sparked, furthered their maturation. Darwin Smith fully blossomed after his experience with cancer. Joe Coleman was profoundly affected by his World War II experiences, particularly that last-minute change of orders that took him off a doomed ship on which he surely would have died. A strong religious belief or conversion might also nurture development of Level 5 traits. Coleman Mockler, for example, converted to evangelical Christianity while getting his MBA at Harvard, and later, according to the book Cutting Edge, became a prime mover in a group of Boston business executives who met frequently over breakfast to discuss the carryover of religious values to corporate life. Other leaders in our study, however, had no obvious catalytic event. They just led normal lives and somehow ended up atop the Level 5 hierarchy. I believe, although I cannot prove, that potential Level 5 leaders are highly prevalent in our society. The problem is not, in my estimation, a dearth of potential Level 5 leaders. They exist all around us if we just know what to look for. And what is that? Look for situations where extraordinary results exist, but where no individual steps forth to claim excess credit. You will likely find a potential Level 5 leader at work. I'd love to be able to give you a list of steps for becoming Level 5. I'd love to be able to give you the simple prescription. but we have no solid research data that would support such a simple prescription. Our research exposed level 5 as a key component inside the black box of what it takes to shift a company from good to great. Yet inside that black box is yet another black box, namely the inner development of a person to level 5. We could speculate on what might be inside that inner black box, but it would be mostly just that, speculation. So in short, level 5 is a very satisfying idea, a powerful idea, and to produce the best transitions from good to great, perhaps an essential idea. A 10-step list, a simple prescription, a simplistic answer would trivialize the concept. One thought is to begin practicing the other good-to-great disciplines we discovered. We found a symbiotic relationship between level 5 and the remaining chapters. On the one hand, level 5 traits enable you to implement the other findings. On the other hand, practicing the other findings helps you to become level 5. Think of it this way. This chapter is about what level 5s are. The rest of this book describes what they do. Leading with the other disciplines can help you move in the right direction. There is no guarantee that doing so will turn you into a full-fledged level 5, but it does give you a tangible place to begin. We cannot say for sure what percentage of people have the seed of level 5 within them, or how many of those can nurture it. Even those of us who discovered level 5 on the research team do not know for ourselves whether we will succeed in fully evolving to level 5. And yet, all of us who worked on the finding have been deeply affected and inspired by the idea. Darwin Smith, Coleman Mockler, Alan Wurtzel, and all the other level 5s we learned about have become models for us, something worthy to aspire toward. Whether or not we make it all the way to level 5, it's worth the effort. For like all basic truths about what is best in human beings, when we catch a glimpse of that truth, we know that our own lives and all that we touch will be better for the effort. The words you've just heard, I wrote in 2000 and 2001, summarizing the findings from good to great. In the intervening years, and now I'm re-recording the book in almost 2005, and in the intervening time, I've had a fascinating experience with level 5, and I'd like to share it with you. See, when we finished those words, I have to admit I was a little bit depressed because I felt, my goodness, these level 5s, they must be just freaks of nature. I mean, how many level 5s can there be? Maybe we're all doomed. It seemed kind of dark to me. And then an astounding thing happened. I started to get emails and correspondence and people stopping me at seminars and talks and saying, you know, Jim, there was this person in my life that was just an amazing creator of results and a spectacular performance and a wonderful team, and I could never really put my finger on what to make of them because they didn't fit into any of the standard models of leadership that I'd read about. It could have been a platoon commander or a teacher or a high school sports coach or a division leader or a Girl Scout council leader. They came in all walks of life, but people would say there was this person, this amazing person in my life, but they just didn't fit the mold of a leader. And yet there they were doing amazing things with a group of people. And then I read the level 5 chapter, and bang, flash, I got it. Jim, that person was a level 5, and now I understand. The level 5 finding helps me understand the remarkable contributions of this person. And this has happened not tens of times, but thousands of times. And as I stand back and reflect upon it, the conclusion I've come to, and I find it an uplifting conclusion, an inspiring conclusion, there's level 5 throughout society. I've come to the conclusion that level 5 is the mortar that holds the bricks of society together. We do have level 5 teachers, and we do have level 5 police chiefs, and we do have level 5 military commanders, and we have level 5 sports coaches, and level 5 people who run homeless centers, and people who run unsung parts of businesses. Our problem is not an absence of level 5 in our society. Our problem is an absence of the wisdom to put them in the positions of responsibility and power. There's so much opportunity, untapped opportunity, if we just take those level 5s and we give them the keys to the car. Level 5 leadership. Key points. At the end of every chapter, I'm going to do a quick summary of bullet points, if you will, of some of the key wrap-up findings from our research in that chapter. I'll do this at the end of every chapter to give you a reminder set of reinforcing ideas to carry into the next chapter. Every good to great leader had level 5 leadership during the pivotal transition years. Level 5 refers to a 5-level hierarchy of executive capabilities with level 5 at the top. Level 5 leaders embody a paradoxical mix of personal humility and professional will. And never forget the definition of a level 5. A level 5 leader is one who is ambitious, first and foremost for the cause, for the company, for the work, not himself or herself, and has the will to make good on it. Level 5 leaders set up their successors for even greater success in the next generation, whereas egocentric level 4 leaders often set their successors for failure. Level 5 leaders display a compelling modesty. They are often self-effacing and understated. In contrast, 2/3 of the comparison companies had leaders with gargantuan personal egos that contributed to the demise or continued mediocrity of the company. Let me be clear about one point, though. We don't want to say that a level 5 leader cannot be charismatic. There have been charismatic level 5 leaders. Sam Walton of Walmart was a charismatic level 5 leader. He was able to build a company that would ultimately transcend him, would go beyond his personal charisma. So I don't want you to get hung up on the idea here that if you have charisma, you can't be level 5. Or that if your leading executive has charisma, that individual cannot be level 5. The critical question is not personality, not charisma, but rather ambition. Are you ambition for the cause, or are you ambition for yourself? Level 5 leaders are fanatically driven, infected with an incurable need to produce sustained results. They are resolved to do whatever it takes to make the company great, no matter how big or hard the decisions. They display a workmanlike diligence, more plow horse than show horse. They look out the window to attribute success to factors other than themselves. When things go poorly, however, they look in the mirror and blame themselves, taking full responsibility. The comparison chief executives often did just the opposite, looking in the mirror to take credit for success, but pointing out the window to assign blame for disappointing results. A question for you right now, wherever you're listening to this. What is your relationship to the window and the mirror? Do you point out the window to give others credit, or do you point out the window to blame other factors when things go badly? What is your relationship to the window and the mirror? One of the most damaging trends in recent history is the tendency, especially by boards of directors, to select a dazzling celebrity leader and to deselect potential level 5 leaders. There were also a few unexpected findings. Larger-than-life celebrity leaders who write in from the outside turn out to be negatively correlated with going from good to great. 10 of 11 of the good-to-great CEOs came from inside the company, whereas the comparison companies tried outside CEOs 6 times more often, and they failed to become great. Level 5 leaders attribute much of their success to good luck rather than to personal greatness. And most important, we were not looking for level 5 leadership in our research, but the data was overwhelming and convincing. We were surprised by the finding. Keep in mind, I had set out at the beginning of the study to not even have a leadership answer of any type, and yet the data was overwhelming, the data led us to the conclusion, the data spoke. Chapter 3. First who, then what? There are going to be times when we can't wait for somebody. Now either you're on the bus or off the bus. Ken Kesey, from The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe. When we began the research project, we expected to find that the first step in taking a company from good to great would be to set a new direction, a new vision and strategy for the company, and then to get people committed and aligned behind that new direction. We found something quite the opposite. The executives who ignited the transformations from good to great did not first figure out where to drive the bus, and then get people to take it there. No, they first got the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus, and then they figured out where to drive it. They said, in essence, look, I don't really know where we should take this bus, but I know this much. If we get the right people on the bus, the right people in the right seats, and the wrong people off the bus, then we'll figure out how to take it someplace great. The good to great leaders understood three simple truths. First, if you begin with who rather than what, you can more easily adapt to a changing world. If people join the bus primarily because of where it's going, well, what happens if you get 10 miles down the road and you need to change direction? You've got a problem. But if people are on the bus because of who else is on the bus, then it's much easier to change direction. Hey, I got on this bus because of who else is on this bus. If we need to change direction to be more successful, that's fine with me. Second, if you have the right people on the bus, the problem of how to motivate and manage people largely goes away. The right people don't need to be tightly managed, or fired up, or motivated, or disciplined. They will be self-motivated, self-inspired, self-disciplined, self-guided. They'll be motivated by the inner drive to produce the best results and to be part of creating something great. Third, if you have the wrong people, it doesn't really matter whether you discover the right direction. You still won't have a great company. Great vision without great people is irrelevant. Consider the case of Wells Fargo during its transition in the 1970s and 80s. Wells Fargo began its 15-year stint of spectacular performance in 1983. But the foundation for that shift dates back to the early 1970s, when then-CEO Dick Cooley began building one of the best, most talented management teams in the industry. The best team, according to investor Warren Buffett. Cooley foresaw that the banking industry would eventually undergo wrenching change, but he didn't pretend to know what form that change would take. So instead of mapping out a strategy for change, he and Chairman Ernie Arbuckle focused on injecting an endless stream of talent directly into the veins of the company. They hired outstanding people whenever and wherever they might find them, often without any specific job. That's how you build the future, said Cooley. If I'm not smart enough to see the changes that are coming, they will. And they'll be flexible enough to deal with them. Cooley's approach proved prescient. No one could predict all the changes that would be wrought by banking deregulation. Yet, when these changes came, no bank handled those challenges better than Wells Fargo. At a time when its sector in the banking industry fell 59% behind the general stock market, Wells Fargo outperformed the market by over 3 times. Carl Reichert, who became CEO in 1983, attributed the bank's success largely to the people around him, most of whom he inherited from Cooley. As he listed members of the Wells Fargo executive team that had joined the company during the Cooley-Reichert era, we were stunned. Nearly every person had gone on to become CEO of a major company. Bill Aldinger became the CEO of Household Finance. Jack Grundhofer became CEO of U.S. Bank Corp. Frank Newman became CEO of Bankers Trust. Richard Rosenberg became CEO of Bank of America. Bob Joss became CEO of Westpac Banking, one of the largest banks in Australia, and later became Dean of the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Not exactly your garden variety executive team. R.J. Miller, an active Wells Fargo board member for 17 years, told us that the Wells Fargo team reminded him of the famed Whiz Kids, recruited to Ford Motor Company in the late 1940s, of which, in fact, Miller was a member. eventually becoming president himself of Ford. Wells Fargo's approach was simple. You get the best people, you build them into the best managers in the industry, and you accept the fact that some of them will be recruited to become CEOs of other companies. Bank of America, the